Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 24th of January, these are our main stories. Four members of an American far-right group have been found guilty of seditious conspiracy in connection with the attack on the US Capitol 2 years ago. Pressure from Ukraine on Germany, which still appears to be sitting on the fence over allowing German-made tanks to be sent to Ukraine. And the federal trial begins as Genaro Garcia Luna, the highest-ranking Mexican official to face drugs charges in the United States. Also in this podcast,
I call on fathers to take the hands of their daughters and walk them to school, even if they're not allowed in.
A special report from Afghanistan, where women and girls are being increasingly isolated by the Taliban. Under a rarely used Civil War-era law, four members of a far-right militia group have been convicted for their part in plotting to stop the certification of President Biden's election victory in 2021. Roberto Minuta, Joseph Hackett, David Marshall and Edward Vallejo, who are all members of the Oath Keepers group, were found guilty of seditious conspiracy for participating in the January the 6th riot, which carries up to 20 years in prison. They were all supporters of Donald Trump. Our Washington correspondent, Gary O'Donoghue, told us more about the Oath Keepers and what they're convicted of.
Well, the Oath Keepers came to the sort of fore in the aftermath of January the 6th as one of the central groups that had instigated, planned, encouraged, organised the riot inside the Capitol. And many of them were former veterans, some of them were former police officers. Many of them had sort of got together online, and effectively the sort of leaders of this group were prosecuted in the wake of the riots, of course. And this is the most serious charge that any of them have faced. Two of them, including the leader of the group itself, Stuart Rhodes, were convicted before Christmas on seditious conspiracy. And the charge really goes back to the Civil War, and it's about the threat to use violence in pursuit of your political ends, in particular in the overthrow of a government.
And how many people have actually been convicted so far for the January the 6th riot? And how many more are awaiting their day in court?
Around 1,000 people have faced different charges, from fairly small misdemeanours right up to these sedition charges. So it's the whole gamut. But the vast majority have pleaded guilty to lesser charges. But these are the sort of serious trials. And actually, at the same time as these verdicts were being handed down today, in the same court building, there were five other defendants from another far-right group called the Proud Boys. If you remember, they were the ones invoked by Donald Trump during that presidential debate with Joe Biden to stand down and stand by, if you remember. Five of their members are on trial for the same charge, and all these will come to a head in the coming weeks, and then the sentencing will take place in the coming months, I think.
That was Gary O'Donoghue in Washington. Ukraine's foreign minister has made a direct plea to countries that have Leopard tanks, urging them to make a formal request to Germany to allow them to hand the tanks over. The Leopard 2 models were originally made in Germany, and countries which bought them are supposed to get German consent before re-exporting them. Poland has already said it will ask for authorization to send the tanks to Ukraine, and Dmytro Kuleba called for other countries to follow suit.
If Germany makes decision on tanks, it will save many lives of Ukrainian soldiers, but it will speed up liberation of Ukrainian territories and therefore also Ukrainian civilians living under occupation and suffering from Russian presence.
Meanwhile, the European Union's policy chief, Josep Borrell, has said he doesn't believe Germany will block countries from sending Ukraine their own Leopard tanks. Our correspondent Damian McGuinness is in Berlin, and he explained why German approval is being sought.
Essentially, this is because of the export rules that Germany has used to send these tanks in the first place to Poland. So Poland can only re-export these if it asks Germany. So these are the rules that Poland has signed up to. Germany traditionally does not send heavy military into an armed conflict or into a war. And that really explains why, for a lot of Germans, this is such a controversial step.
How likely is some sort of firm decision from Germany to happen soon?
Well, I think the idea of German Chancellor Olaf Scholz making a firm decision and telling everyone about it is the difficulty for a lot of critics of the Chancellor. Now, the difficulty is not only Mr. Scholz's, what some would say would be prevaricating, but I think it's also his communication style. Traditionally, what he likes to do is make a decision behind the scenes, look at all the different options, weigh it up, look at the pros and cons, and then tell everyone about it later. That's how he views leadership. For a lot of people, it's this lack of communication which is irritating and also quite confusing. He's not really explaining what the reasons are, because the reasons seem to shift from one minute it's because you need to cooperate with allies, the next it's because you don't want to exacerbate the conflicts, but the reasons seem to change.
And looking at the domestic politics that Chancellor Scholz is dealing with, how much unanimity is there amongst his coalition partners over what should happen regarding tanks?
There's no cohesion at all. He's in a coalition with the Liberals and with the Greens. Both of those parties are very vocal, saying that Germany needs to send its own tanks to Ukraine and also allow other countries to send German-made tanks to Ukraine. Even within Mr. Scholz's own centre-left Social Democrat SPD party, the more centrist end of that party is also quite critical of the Chancellor. What you have, though, you have a large minority of German voters, many of them left-wing, centre-left. You also have a hardcore left-wing of his own Social Democrat Party. And both of those segments of the population quite like his slow approach. What they see that as is not rushing into an escalation. Some people in Germany do welcome the idea of not going too quickly into throwing arms into what is an increasingly difficult war.
Damian McGuinness in Berlin. Away from the battlefield, Russia seems to be having some success in the information war over who's to blame for the fighting in the first place. New analysis suggests that sizable portions of the populations of several European countries believe that Russia's invasion was justified because of NATO provocation. And they believe it, says the research, because of Moscow's disinformation. Our security correspondent Frank Gardner has this report.
From a quiet backstreet office in Helsinki, analysts have been closely monitoring opinions in NATO countries on the war in Ukraine. The results, they say, are alarming. Russian disinformation about who is to blame for the war is having a noticeable effect. Messages and videos have been posted frequently online.
Господь велик! Мы воюем против сатанистов.
19% of Germans polled said they viewed Russia's invasion as a justified response to provocation by NATO. In Slovakia, that figure rose to 30%. In both Slovakia and Hungary, more than a quarter of those polled believed the Kremlin's narrative that Russia's invasion was necessary to disarm and denazify Ukraine. In both Greece and Italy, many respondents said they held Ukraine, the EU or the US responsible for the war. The findings have been collated by the Centre of Excellence for Hybrid Threats, a joint NATO-EU centre that analyses a broad spectrum of threats, mostly coming from Russia. These range from disinformation and interference in elections to underwater sabotage and subtle attempts to undermine Western democracy through online propaganda.
Frank Gardner. Since seizing power in Afghanistan almost a year and a half ago, the Taliban have relentlessly squeezed the space for women and girls. Last month, they announced a ban on female students attending universities. The BBC's Yalda Hakim has returned to Afghanistan to speak to those now having to deal with those restrictions.
I've just arrived in west of Kabul at the Roshan University. And this is where about 450 women used to come to learn subjects like journalism, engineering, economics, subjects that the Taliban deemed inappropriate for women. This university, this space, is closed. As I come through the rusty gate, images of girls, boys, women learning in the classroom, singing their anthem, painting. Deserted now. No space for them to come and learn anymore. I'm about to go and meet Professor Ismail Mashal, who began this institute. When the order to ban women from universities came, Professor Mashal was shocked. He could have kept his institute open for male students, but he didn't think that was fair, so he shut it completely.
Leave these women alone. In the last year and a half, all their policies have been focused on women covering up. girls not going to school. There are bigger issues we need to deal with.
Professor Mashal has brought me down to the basement, which is where the library is, full of books. And he says this space was once full of life, and now it's completely empty. The computers, the desks and chairs, the books are all covered in dust.
In a rare act of defiance, an emotional Professor Mashal tore his academic records live on television. It went viral on social media. His actions surprised many. Women cheered. He's now calling on other men to join his campaign.
I call on fathers to take the hands of their daughters and walk them to school, even if they're not allowed in. They should do this daily. It's the least they can do to prove they are men.
The ban is temporary, says the Taliban government. They claim they're trying to create an Islamic learning environment aligned with Sharia practices. Since the Taliban takeover in August 2021, most girls over the age of 12 haven't been able to go to school. Women have been banned from parks and gyms and can only travel long distances with a male guardian. This shopping district in northern Kabul is called Lycée Mariam, and it's famous for where women come to buy clothes and get the goods and supplies that they want. But now it's virtually empty. There are women here with faces covered and concerned and nervous about our cameras, why we're here. Some of them tell me that they're here to get their goods and go back.
I don't have the right for working, for existence. I don't have the right for being a woman anymore. It's a crime.
Naila Mirza, a medical student, was weeks away from getting her degree. The Taliban's ban means she's left with nothing.
Suddenly, everything changed in a matter of a day. They took everything from us. I used to say it proudly to everyone that I'm finishing this journey of studying medicine.
Just 4 months ago, she told me she was determined to stay and fight. But that changed when the university ban was imposed. Naila has fled Afghanistan.
It's over for me. I mean, staying here and staying dead is the same thing.
That was medical student Naila Mirza speaking to Yalda Hakim. Chefs at some of the world's top restaurants have been speaking about violence and bullying in the workplace. A study by Cardiff University heard from 62 chefs at Michelin-starred restaurants around the globe who said they had endured abuse to succeed in the industry. Our Wales correspondent Hoel Griffith reports.
What are you doing? I can't take it anymore.
Steeped in tension and simmering tempers, the British film Boiling Point gives a fictional account of what life can be like in a top restaurant kitchen. Research by Cardiff Business School suggests the reality may be even more explosive. With accounts from dozens of chefs at fine dining establishments around Europe, the US, Asia, and here in the UK. Speaking anonymously, many describe a culture where exposure to threats and violence is seen as both formative and beneficial. One chef described the result of being attacked at work. His words are spoken by a BBC producer.
He picked up his bread knife from the middle of the kitchen and just had it to my neck in front of everyone. He said, "I'm going to kill you," and that was traumatising. Not so long after that, I got moved to the flagship, the 3-Michelin-star restaurant. They thought, "This guy's good."
Many chefs spoke of the injuries they endured at work, with competitions to hold people's hands in hot fat fryers and stories of cuts being cauterised on kitchen stoves. The research, published in the journal Human Relations, concludes that suffering has become a core part of an elite chef's identity and how they're valued in the restaurant industry.
Hoel Griffith. Still to come on the Global News Podcast.
You're flying on a moving mountain and going just at extreme speeds. I feel truly present and time seems to slow down.
We'll hear from one of the first women to take part in a surfing competition with some of the biggest waves in the world. There's a new warning about the potential risks of depending too much on Chinese technology, particularly the tiny sensors used in many everyday items. This latest one comes from a former UK diplomat and current China watcher, Charles Parton, who's written a paper about the dangers of Chinese-made cellular IoT modules being built into devices like smart speakers, thermostats, and even security systems. He told us more about the sensors and how they work.
They're usually much smaller than 5 centimetres, and they're embedded with sensors. They've got software, they've got antennae, they've got processors. They communicate with each other, and they form a mesh, and they exchange and process vast amounts of data about their environment. They're very much used in industrial processes, logistics, security, defence. So they collect an enormous amount of data, which is processed and analysed and researched, and then feeds back in to improve those processes. So what worries me is two things. One is an enormous amount of data that is egressing and potentially going back to China. And secondly, their aim is to get a monopoly on the market. And once you've done that, then we are dependent upon them. And they have considerable leverage on us on policies that are outside the technical area.
The world clearly needs this sort of kit. So what does your report suggest is the way forward?
They are already in so many things that actually to do what they call as a rip and replace and take them all out, all Chinese ones, I think would be unfeasible. But what we can do is say that almost immediately from now on, any of these devices should not be installed in things that are sensitive, government programs that might be sensitive, critical national infrastructure, things like that, anything to do with defence. And in the longer term, perhaps with a moratorium of a year or two, prevent them from being installed in other things. My point would be that if China is a hostile power, which it is, then it would be irresponsible of governments to allow them to get hold of data in a whole variety of areas and create these dependencies. So it is a very serious matter that government needs to take seriously, but one of which at the moment they don't really have much idea about. I mean, when you say the words cellular Internet of Things modules to your average government official or political parties, parliaments, they don't really know what you're talking about. And I think the important thing is that they start to learn what we're talking about.
Charles Parton. A former minister in the Mexican government has gone on trial in New York, accused of accepting huge bribes from a drugs cartel. Genaro Garcia Luna is the highest-ranking Mexican official to face drug trafficking charges in the US. The former public security minister was arrested in 2019 by US federal agents and charged with cocaine trafficking, conspiracy, and engaging in a continuing criminal enterprise. Prosecutors allege he allowed one of Mexico's most feared drugs gangs, the Sinaloa cartel, to operate with impunity. Our correspondents, Neda Taufik in New York, followed by Will Grant in Mexico City, report on the case and its potential impact on both sides of the border.
I'm outside the federal courthouse in Brooklyn, where Garcia Luna is on trial right now. This is also where the notorious drug kingpin El Chapo was convicted 3 years ago. Then the world was provided a window into the gruesome inner workings of the cartels and their alleged links to political power. It had all the makings of a Hollywood crime thriller, and many see this as its sequel. Raids like these were meant to show Mexico's government was actively going after the cartels. But during the El Chapo trial, one of the many bombshell allegations was that the top security official in charge of taking down these powerful gangs was all along protecting them.
The former cartel accountant said he personally delivered bribes to Mexico's former federal security chief.
The witness was speaking about Mr. Garcia Luna. He testified that he personally delivered briefcases with millions in cash to him. Mr. Garcia Luna responded at the time that it was a defamatory lie.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to Secretary Garcia Luna.
Garcia Luna was the public face of Mexico's so-called war on drugs, often invited as a guest speaker in the United States to talk about needed reforms, including how to fight corruption.
We have to talk about corruption.
He was a trusted partner to top U.S. officials in the DEA and FBI. Revelations from this trial could prove embarrassing for past administrations in Mexico, where my colleague Will Grant is following the reaction.
The thing to bear in mind about Mr. Garcia Luna is just how much of a big fish he was in Felipe Calderón's administration. This was arguably the most senior law enforcement figure in the country, present at the very start of Mexico's brutal drug war. So his fall from grace has been nothing short of spectacular, and the Mexican public are keen to find out exactly how it all ends.
Evidentemente, era muy influyente.
At his daily news conference, President Andrés Manuel López Obrador, or AMLO as he's known, said that Mr. García Luna raises some uncomfortable questions for several U.S. agencies, too.
López Obrador thinks that he is going to get some kind of edge out of this.
Professor Rodolfo Soriano Núñez in Mexico City believes that President López Obrador may find it harder than he thinks to use Mr. García Luna's trial for his own political benefit.
It is not about who leads the war on drugs here in Mexico. It's about the key institution in that war, and that's the army. And the army is tainted.
AMLO promised a different security approach when he came to office, yet his policy remains much the same as his predecessors. The military engaged in a seemingly endless fight against cartels at war with each other. Amid such bloodshed, Genaro García Lunes's legal battle may perhaps shed some more light on the Mexican state's murky complicity in that conflict.
That was Will Grant in Mexico City, and before him we heard from Neda Taufik in New York. The UN Office on Drugs and Crime says fewer victims of human trafficking were identified in 2020 during the COVID-19 pandemic. However, in a new report, the body says pandemic restrictions might have driven the crimes underground. Bethany Bell reports from Vienna, where the UNODC is based.
The UNODC report said the number of trafficking victims detected globally fell by 11% in 2020 compared to the previous year. It said pandemic restrictions may have temporarily made it harder for traffickers to operate. But it said the pandemic may also have weakened law enforcement and driven trafficking crimes into more concealed spaces. The report expressed concern that most victims escaped from traffickers by themselves instead of being identified by the authorities. Convictions of traffickers, it said, were decreasing. It said women were three times more likely to suffer extreme violence during trafficking than men, and children almost twice as often as adults.
Bethany Bell. Now, in our earlier podcast, we reported on the return of one of the world's most prestigious big wave surfing contests in Hawaii after a seven-year hiatus. The Eddie Aikau Big Wave Invitational saw swells of up to 12 metres, and as you will also have heard, this year female surfers competed alongside the men for the first time in the 39-year history of the contest. One of them is Paige Arms, and she spoke to Razia Iqbal from Maui, Hawaii, and told her just why the Eddie is so special.
The Eddie Aikau Invitational is by far the most iconic, special big wave event and maybe surfing event ever. The conditions were flawless. The swell was a lot bigger than anticipated. It takes a certain size swell for them to run this event, and it doesn't happen very often. It needs a specific direction of the storm coming towards the Hawaiian Islands. And this was by far one of the best eddies, if not the best one ever.
The first time that women have been allowed to participate, that seems pretty extraordinary. Why have they not been allowed to previously?
The only thing that I can think of is that there are only a very small number of women in the world surfing big waves, and an even smaller group of women that like surfing big waves like that. I mean, there were six in this event and 34 men. There's probably 10 really, really good female big wave surfers in the world.
Well, what does it mean to you to have been able to take part?
This was definitely one of the biggest privileges that I've ever had, and to have heats alongside some of my heroes and mentors growing up, to do it all in the name of Eddie Aikau and the legacy that he left behind. I think we'll all be talking about this one for a long time.
Is it possible to describe what it feels like when you are surfing such extraordinarily high waves?
If I could put it into words, I'd describe it like you're flying. You're going at Mach speed on top of the surface of the ocean, and you're using the power of the ocean to propel you forward. you're flying on a moving mountain and going just at extreme speeds. I feel truly present and time seems to slow down.
This competition is named after Eddie Aiku, who was not just a lifeguard. He was also famous for being somebody who wanted to ride waves that no one else was really prepared to dare to ride. What do you know about him?
He gave his life trying to save his friends. He was a huge inspiration to all of his peers. And I know that he really, truly loved riding big waves. Events like this are just so special. It brings thousands and thousands of people to the beach to watch big wave surfing. And to have that done in his name, I'm sure he's smiling down on all of us.
Paige Arms speaking to Razia Iqbal. By the age of 3, a toddler might be expected to know their own age or be able to count to 10. But what about counting to 100 in 7 languages? Teddy Hobbs from Somerset in the southwest of England can do exactly that. He has become the UK's youngest member of Mensa, a society for people in the top 2% of IQs. Our correspondent Dan Johnson went to meet him.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Teddy Hobbs is the brightest of young boys, who even enjoys maths in French. It's one of 6 languages, other than English, in which he can count to 100, baffling his mum Beth.
Très bien.
So he could count to 100 before he was 2. But I just assumed, you know, every child has their own quirk. Each child develops slightly quicker in something else than the other ones, and we just assumed that was his thing.
To become a member of Mensa.
He was accepted into Mensa last year after his IQ was measured at 139.
So he was 3 years and 7 months, and it said his letter and word recognition was at 8 years and 10 months. What are you cutting it out to make?
A shape of Kenya.
Even Play-Doh becomes a geography lesson.
People will think, you must be a pushy parent, you must have encouraged this.
Teddy has done all of this himself. When we go out and we give him the option of a treat, he wants a book rather than chocolate.
Thank you for coming to play.
Thank you for letting us come and play.
Thank you. Bye.
The very talented Teddy Hobbs speaking to Dan Johnson, who's also very talented. Now to a story that has been generating a lot of interest online. Sophie from Romania is a rescue dog who's been adopted by the BBC's former technology correspondent Rory Kethlin-Jones and his wife, Professor Diane Coyle. So what's the big deal about that? Well, Sophie is extremely shy, but that hasn't stopped Rory from regularly tweeting updates. And it's led to something of a cult following around the world. So how is she getting on? Amol Rajan got the latest from Rory.
Well, Sophie's out. That's the big
thing.
Wow. Out from behind the sofa. For 4.5 weeks, nearly 5 weeks, every morning I'd come down and she'd be behind the sofa, and she might come out during the day and she might not. The last 2 or 3 mornings I've come down and she's been out in the kitchen or under the kitchen table. I don't know if you're watching on the Zoom call that I'm on, but she's constantly circling the kitchen table right now. So that is progress. She's still very timid, particularly with me. My wife, the professor, has already left for some high-level economics conference in Oxford and won't be back for 2 days. And Sophie's going, well, where's the boss?
How did you do that, Rory? What was the secret to getting Sophie to slowly come forth?
To be honest, we have obeyed the teachings of Simon, who you're going to hear from in a moment, who's told us just to be incredibly patient. Maybe offer a treat to come out, just walk at her pace and don't force it at all. And gradually, she's begun to trust us. I've put a little video up this morning where I'm in the kitchen and she quite likes to watch us both in the kitchen, particularly Diane. But she doesn't quite trust me yet, whereas with Diane, she will actually take food from her hand from time to time.
Simon Wooler, a dog trainer, behaviour consultant. How did you hear about Sophie and how did you get in touch with Rory?
My partner Nina noticed it on Twitter and noticed Sophie's arrival and what the variety of advice that Rory was getting over the Twitter replies. So I sent a message to Rory via private messaging just to say, I can help if you need it. And from then on, we've talked on WhatsApp, we've talked over Zoom, and culminating last week in me going down to London to see how things were going.
Wow. What's the advice you have been giving him? I mean, there'd be owners of shy dogs everywhere that are desperate to know what do they need to do.
the message really is, as Rory describes it, which is take your time, go at their pace. What they're experiencing isn't a choice, it's an emotional response to their situation. So we've been pairing Rory and the environment and Diane with something positive that Sophie already likes, and she's got quite sophisticated tastes, like steak and bacon.
Rory, it's worth saying you spent many years chronicling technology for good and for ill. This does show some of the more positive aspects of social media, doesn't it? Because you have generated this huge following, this huge community, and Sophie's become sort of Insta-famous, I think they might call it.
Oh, she's coming up to me right now and going, what's going on? We've been completely overwhelmed by the reaction. As you know, I've been tweeting an awful long time. It's been just a tidal wave of interest and love and advice, some of it good, some of it bad. And it just seems to have caught the public imagination in some way.
That was Rory Ketlin-Jones and dog trainer and behaviour consultant Simon Wooler speaking to Amol Rajan about Sophie from Romania. And yes, I will tweet a picture with the hashtag GlobalNewsPets so you can find her. And that's it from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you'd like to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, do please send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter @GlobalNewsPod. This edition was mixed by Javed Gilani. The producer was Emma Joseph. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Jackie Leonard, and until next time, goodbye.